from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvard super strategist Michael Porter is famed for his groundbreaking advice to megacorporations, nations, whole regions of the earth. Now he has some advice for the U.S. healthcare industry. Get cured or risk killing the national economy. And the cure, he says, is a new kind of competition among health providers, not for which stingy HMO can offer the cheapest, most grudging service, but for which hospital, clinic, doctor can offer the most excellent care for a patient's particular need, for your need. We spoke earlier to Michael Porter, so won't be able to take your calls this hour, but listen closely, there's a radical prescription here. Tonight, On Point, Michael Porter and a new competitive vision for American healthcare. Joining me is Michael Porter, university professor at Harvard Business School, where he's director of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness. His article, Redefining Competition in Healthcare, appears in the June issue of Harvard Business Review. Welcome, Michael Porter.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So why are you, out of all the things in the world you could be focusing on right now, focusing on healthcare and the transformation of healthcare?
Well, it's one of those topics that just won't go away. It keeps recurring as one of the major issues facing the American economy. But as I travel the world, I find that virtually every country is fretting about their healthcare system, how to structure their healthcare system, because many countries are seeing the same kind of pattern we are, which is costs are going up and up and up. But it's not at all clear. In fact, it's quite clear that it's not true, that that means that quality is going up and up. We're seeing really very, very unsatisfactory outcomes. This is getting to be a big part of our GNP, but yet the quality of the competition in healthcare is clearly something's wrong.
A big enough problem that it is a threat to the U.S. economy?
It absolutely is a major cost. I read somewhere recently that it costs about $1,000 per Ford vehicle produced in America.
In healthcare benefits
in
Ford workers.
For Ford workers, absolutely. So that's a big deal.
That is a big deal. You point to competitiveness or the lack of competitiveness at the heart of this problem, yet you point out that the U.S. healthcare industry, even as it is today, is one of the more competitive healthcare industries in the world. So what's the problem here?
Well, it's a little bit subtle. We do have probably the most private system. We do have the system where there is the most competition, and we're sort of assaulted with that competition. We see the health plans competing and with the hospitals, and the hospitals competing among themselves, and we see employers putting great pressure on their health plans. So there's a lot of competition going on. But the basic problem is that it's actually the wrong competition. What's going on is what we characterize in this article as a kind of a zero-sum competition. It's really about shifting cost or benefits from one party to another in the system rather than addressing the true value of the healthcare provided.
So in an industry or a market where there's good competition going on, what should the effects of that be?
Well, we see it all around us. We see that in healthy competition, you costs should be going down, mm-hmm. things should be getting more efficient, quality should be going up, defects should be declining. The people that don't do a good job should be going out of business, and the people that are efficient should be growing and taking over. Innovation should be flourishing. New ideas should be rapidly adopted in the industry, because if you don't, you're out of business.
So hold that screen up to the American healthcare industry.
And
how does it look?
And we see this kind of almost complete opposite. We see a situation where costs are high, higher than almost any place in the world. In fact, I think of any major country, we have the highest healthcare costs, but they're still rising as fast as everywhere else.
The charts are still zooming toward the ceiling.
If there is a ceiling. But rising costs are not accompanied by improving quality.
Not accompanied.
In fact, all the evidence suggests that quality is low and declining in many respects. Now, again, let me be clear here. The best American healthcare is probably the best in the world. In our top providers, in Brigham and Women's Hospital, we have excellent healthcare. But what we're talking here is about the average data that characterizes the average experience.
The experience most Americans are likely to have.
The experience that most Americans are likely to have. And what we're finding is that instead of quality going up, we're seeing more and more kind of restriction of services. We see actually what care is provided, lags the accepted medical standard. So there's been a lot of work on, you know, what's the level of care for a particular condition, mm-hmm. and all the studies show that Americans don't receive that level of care.
So we know what it is. We know what it should be. If you've got a particular problem, disease, sickness, we know what should happen, and it's not happening
right.
in spite of all that money being spent.
That is correct, and despite all the knowledge and the research that's been done. We see enormous differences across providers and across geography in the cost of healthcare as well as the quality of healthcare. And yet there's no correlation. The areas with the highest cost do not have the highest quality. In fact, it's often the opposite. Instead of having innovations rapidly diffuse and adopted by healthcare providers, we see the opposite. We see, I think it takes an average of around 17 years for a accepted, approved practice to actually diffuse to the average provider. So there's a very slow process by which the new ideas get adopted, and the bad providers don't go out of business.
And I mean, this, in the vaunted system that we're told again and again by American leaders, is the pride of the world.
Right. And actually, all the data suggests that it really isn't the pride of the world. We don't have the best medical outcomes. We don't have the best life expectancy. We don't have the best infant mortality. So there's kind of this little secret that actually, on the ground level, on where most Americans consume healthcare, actually the quality is not anything we would aspire to.
Michael Porter, I'm so glad to hear you talking about this subject. I think many Americans know this in their day-to-day experience and their family's experience of health care, but there's been no sort of cavalry to come to the rescue. I mean, this idea of a profoundly shifting way of looking at this is exciting, but what's the shift that you're encouraging here?
Well, let's go a little bit deeper into the state of affairs. By the way, I should tell you, the number of medical deaths every year from medical errors mm-hmm. in the United States are estimated to be at least as high as the total number of deaths from automobile accidents.
Good
so it may be
God.
Indeed the leading cause of death. So again, this is our vaunted healthcare delivery system. So why is competition failing? Why do we see wonderful progress in long-distance telephone service and computers and industry after industry? We have American companies that are second to none in terms of competitiveness. What's going wrong here? Mm. Well, we think it's actually the way the competition has been structured. And what's happened is that incentives and policies and strategies have been put in place that create a competition that is what we call a zero-sum competition. That is, it's a competition that actually doesn't increase the value of health care provided, which is what you want competition to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually competition that shifts value from one system participant to another.
So, give us a sense of how it's poorly structured, in your word.
Well, I mean, for example, what kind of competition actually occurs? Well, the first kind of competition occurs when health plans compete to sign you up.
Oh, we see that all the time.
And there's a lot of noise about that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the argument we make is that's the wrong place for competition to occur. When you sign up for a health plan, you don't know what problem you're going to have. You don't know what provider is going to be the best provider to deal with whatever situation you have. We don't want the competition to be there. We want the competition actually to be around who can do the best job of diagnosing and treating particular medical conditions. The competition ought to be at the disease-by-disease, patient-by-patient level, not at the level of which health plan should you sign up for, which hospital network should you be part of.
That's so far from what we do now, it's hard to imagine. Currently, people compete for my business,
right.
Or maybe through my employer.
I
sign up if I'm lucky enough to have health insurance.
Right.
And then I'm in their hands when crunch time comes.
And
what are you suggesting?
Well, then you're in the network, and then because you're in the network, basically all your
options are there.
Your service are going to be provided in that network.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if the network provider of diabetes care is the best network provider, the lowest cost, the highest value. In fact, we don't even know that because we don't have any of the right information.
But how would I live along until the crunch comes, the disease, the health issue comes, and then have a competition? Hey, I've got diabetes. Who wants to bid for my problem?
Well, and this is jumping to one of our recommendations, we don't believe that there's any legitimate reason for restrictions on who you should see to treat whatever condition you have. We think that basically that's where there should be open competition. There should be no restriction. But what's happened is that once the health plan signs you up, you're locked in. And we've suppressed the competition where it's the most important.
When I'm sick and I need help.
When you're sick and you know what problem you have, or you have a sense for what problem you have, and you want to find the best person that's going to help you, you can't see them.
And exactly at that point, when I want to have the best care that is out there for the problem I have, that's off limits and
competition's not engaged. You're locked in. And if you try to go out of network, you pay Byzantine extra charges and so forth. So basically what's happened is that we're competing to shift cost, not to create value. So basically the health plan tries to shift cost to us by denying payment or sending us that extra bill. You know, we all get these bills from our health plan. What the hell? What is this bill? And basically a lot of those bills are not correct. But see, it's a little known fact that even if you're a paid up subscriber to your health plan, you, the consumer, still bear the ultimate responsibility for the bill. So the health plan can just send you a bill that may be wrong, and then the hospital comes after you, okay? So the health plan has all kinds of faulty incentives here. So what we find is that the competition that we really want has been suppressed. The competition that exists is really about cost shifting. Can the health plan push down the price to the hospital? Then the hospital consolidates into a big hospital group.
Right.
And they have a lot of bargaining power. So they go back to the health plan and push up their prices. So
basically, every city will have a group of groups like that.
Right. And they're shifting of costs back and forth. Now the government's getting in the game. You know, the presidential candidates, particularly the Kerry side, is saying, okay, look, the government will pay for more.
So is that a solution in your view?
That's not a solution.
Not at all. Just another shifting of
costs.
That's
just another shifting. It means that the government's bearing more of the bill and the patient or the employer is bearing less. That doesn't create real value. Real value is created when providers get more expert, more skilled, more sophisticated at treating a particular condition. And we know that that can happen if we can just force competition and allow competition to work.
We're going to come back after a break and talk about how we might get to that point. But I think for a lot of listeners, this will be hard to picture. Paint a picture, if you would, of what a well-functioning competitive health system might look like from a consumer's point of view.
Well, I think the first thing is that you would sign up for a health plan. Ideally, you'd sign up for a health plan and you'd make a multi-year commitment to the health plan and the health plan would make a multi-year commitment to you.
Okay, but I'm not trapped in their services somehow?
Well, you could choose to sign up for a year or you could choose to sign up for 3 years. Mm-hmm. But if you were a smart consumer, you'd actually choose to sign up for 3 years because you want your health plan to really help you invest in really dealing with your problems rather than just taking the short-term cost-saving way of doing so. Okay, you'd be in a health plan, though that health plan would not restrict who you could go for treatment or diagnosis. Instead, the job of that health plan would be to inform you and educate you about who's the best value. And they would do that based on information. See, another radical missing link in the healthcare system in the United States is information. We don't even know how many times a doctor that we visit has treated a particular problem.
And this almost by design. Doctors and hospitals don't want these numbers up.
Well, they're threatening. We don't even know how many times they've done a particular surgery. You can't find out. Much less how many complications they've had, you know, how many, what the recovery times have been. So basically all of us as patients today are flying blind. We're trusting our primary care physician to make a good referral, but even our primary care physician, no matter how hardworking, no matter how diligent they are, doesn't have the information either.
So in this ideal world, I sign up for some years with a care provider, and then they point me to the best provider of any particular service that I need.
Yeah, their job is to collect and provide information, and to be your, listen to this, be your coach, be your advisor. Help you find the best provider by educating you, by telling you what the accepted standards of care are for this particular disease, and helping you navigate through the system to find that provider that really fits whatever condition you have.
But how can they do that when presumably they're trying to hold my costs down? That's what we're all accustomed to.
See, that's the way they hold their costs down. They hold their costs down by facilitating the right kind of competition. See, they want to play all these providers off against each other to see who's the best. And what we find is that the best providers – We know from business competition that the highest quality is often the lowest cost.
Because they just do it best. They know how to do it, and they do it a lot.
And they do it right the first time. And they don't have errors, and they don't have mistakes, and they don't have rehospitalizations.
We're talking tonight with Michael Porter, world-renowned expert on competitive strategy and economic development. In 1999, Fortune magazine called him the single most important strategist working today. Now he's pointing all of that at healthcare. He's director of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness at Harvard Business School. We recorded this earlier, so we're not taking calls this hour, but there's a lot more to come. Stick with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with world-renowned strategy expert Michael Porter. He's director of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness at Harvard Business School, been an advisor to nations, vast corporations, and now is looking at America's healthcare system. He says it's plagued by a lack of competitiveness. His article, Redefining Competition in Healthcare, is in the June issue of the Harvard Business Review. Michael Porter, I hope you'll lay out more of the attributes of what you'd see as a well-functioning, competitive environment for American healthcare, healthcare that is incredibly expensive, and you say not only going up in cost, but going down in quality, something that has to be turned around. One thing you mentioned, and we should come back to it, is the right objective. You say the right objective is improving value, not just lowering cost. That, again, is something that seems outside a lot of Americans' experience in recent years. What do you mean exactly? How would that happen?
Well, Tom, I think that, we've been – the system and all the players have been fixated with cost. And clearly, in the long run, we definitely want cost to decline. But that is not the objective. You know, the best way to lower the cost of healthcare is just to not treat people.
Right.
And a kind of a more elegant way of saying that is rationing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which
and,
you say is essentially what we're involved in right now.
And a lot of that is going on. A lot of that is going on because we're not providing the care that even the generally accepted medical standard would provide.
And so, you can feel this in the doctor's office. A condition comes up and you feel the doctor measuring whether or not to suggest care that might be appropriate.
That might be appropriate, exactly. So we've been focused on reducing cost, not on increasing value. And value in healthcare is really the health outcome per dollar spent.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if the health outcome is better, it might make sense to spend more. And when you measure value, you've got to measure it over the longer term. So you got to make sure that what you're doing today is actually going to ultimately produce this kind of a sustainable improvement. Whereas right now we've got a system where a hospital gets you out of the hospital very quickly because mm-hmm. they know that if something goes wrong and there's a complication and you come back, they can admit you again and get paid again.
An admission fee,
and they get another charge.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what we've got is a system where implicitly the assumption is that all providers are equal. And therefore, since all providers are basically the same, all we have to worry about is cost. But, of course, what we know is all providers are not equal.
And here comes the Michael Porter theme. You've said it with nations. You've said it with industries beyond healthcare. Now you're saying healthcare providers, whether hospitals or doctors, are not all equal
not
in how
all
they address any condition, specific conditions?
In how they address specific conditions. In fact, the hospitals and healthcare providers, particularly hospitals, have made the classic strategy error, which is to try to be all things to all people.
Mm-hmm.
They offer virtually every service line for every kind of patient, for every age group, for every every possible permutation and combination. And in fact, as a result of their desire to accumulate bargaining power to do the cost shifting with the health plan,
right,
hospitals have merged and they've consolidated and they've got big hospital networks.
We
now
see this all the time.
We
now
see these all across the country.
Mm-hmm.
In North Carolina, we see it in Texas. We see
mm-hmm.
it all across the country, these big hospital groups. And the hospital group then is even more broadline. Rather than focusing on those excellence in individual areas of treatment. So the whole focus of competition has been on the wrong thing. Hospitals are competing to get bigger and broader when they are should be competing to get more unique and more distinctive at the disease-by-disease level.
So does this then parallel your kind of prescription for companies, you know, find your competitive advantage and pursue it very deeply? What kind of specialty might a hospital or a medical group, I don't know, have expertise in? Give us some examples where I would go to X for one kind of disease, Y for another, such as?
Oh, you know, where do we start? I mean, think of the Texas Heart Institute. This is a major hospital. All they do is treat heart patients.
Mm-hmm.
They take on the hardest patients. They have everybody in that facility is an expert in cardiac treatment, cardiac surgery. They don't have generic operating rooms. They have operating rooms that are designed to deal with cardiac patients. Every nurse, every orderly, every technician is trained in that area. They have remarkable results. They are lower cost, even though they take on the hardest patients. We've got the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Again, broadline cancer provider.
And where is that one?
That's also in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just picking
mm-hmm.
two Texas
sure,
examples.
Sure.
We have these all over the country, but they are the exception. The typical hospital in America is a broadline provider. It does pretty much everything. And it hasn't really thought about how to specialize or focus in that set of areas where it could be unique. Now, that could be in treating older people. It could be in treating younger people. It could be in treating
hip replacements, or you name it.
I mean, we have in Boston, we have especially orthopedic hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a few of those, but that has been the exception. But that ought to be the rule.
So how would this work then? I don't know, some kind of condition. Am I still going to be treated locally? Am I going to be flown to Texas or North Carolina or Boston for that treatment?
Well, you ought to decide based on information. And one of our major points is that right now you don't even hear about the options that are not local. Basically, your choice is among local providers. But you really ought to have a choice of regional and national providers because we see tremendous differences across geography in terms of how effective and cost-effective the providers are in particular conditions. And so you and your health plan and your family
mm-hmm.
ought to be saying, okay, here I have the following condition. Where are the best people in this region? And you ought to be making choices based on what you think will provide the best value to you. And
but
your health plan ought to be helping you.
But, of course, right now many health plans are not, and many local hospitals have a great vested interest in keeping their competition as circumscribed as possible.
Right, exactly. And that's another example of how the right kind of competition, the competition that really drives value, has been all but eliminated in the system. And the competition that we have is all about cost-shifting competition. See?
So here's a new world. Michael Porter, you outline it, where people specialize in the thing they do best. They become very, very good in that, in delivering value. And ultimately, there's a kind of cost control in that as well. You're not doing redundant treatments and bad treatments and malpractice and all the rest.
Right.
But, you know, every time we've tried to tiptoe into health care reform, and I don't even know if this has ever been the explicit goal, but every time the country has tried, it's just stumbled and floundered
mm-hmm.
and gone essentially not much of anywhere. How do you put the dynamite into the current system to propel toward this vision that you've got?
Well, this truly does require many of the actors in the system to behave in different ways. And I think, you know, there's a number of different ways to get from here to there. But we actually believe that the employer, who in America is the sort of intermediary that pays directly for most health plans, and they, again, of course, we contribute to our employers paying for our health plan.
Right, and paying now somewhere north of $6,000 per employee
right,
for their annual
exactly.
cost in the United States.
And again, what the employers are being forced to do is cost shift to us, the employees.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, steadily, year by year, we pay a little bit higher percentage of the mm-hmm. overall share because they just simply don't feel they can afford the increase. So we believe that the employer actually is in a kind of strategic role to start driving change in the right direction. Many of the employers are large corporations. They have sophisticated personnel. They in fact, one of the ironies here is that, you know, I work mostly with companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so it pains me to say that most employers completely forgot all that they know about purchasing when they purchase health care.
Because it's kind of a black box.
Because
whatever.
They just assigned it to, you know, a certain staff and kind of put it off their radar screen. But what we know is that, you know, when you buy an important service, you ought to be testing the providers against each other to see who does the best job. You ought to be collecting information. And employers didn't do that. They simply shifted everything onto the health plan, said to the health plan, you do it. And then the health plans have created this dysfunctional kind of zero-sum competition that we talked about. So we think employers actually, by actually demanding a new product from their health plan, could go a long way to starting to eliminate the restrictions on provider choice, to stimulate the collection of the right kind of information. We haven't even talked about billing. I mean, if you have a hospital stay, you're going to get hundreds of bills, dozens of bills. Mm-hmm. That's silly. You know, every industry on the planet has figured out how to send you one bill for your hospital stay or for your course of treatment that has the doctor's fee on it and the drug cost on it and the room and board fee. And so we need to simplify billing.
So you know corporations very well. What will shift their effort from cost containment, which essentially is how I read what they've been doing in recent years, keep the cost down somehow, to remaking the healthcare industry?
Yep. I think employers are now understanding that no amount of pressure and bargaining power is going to work. I think everybody's kind of despairing that, you know, we had this great hope that managed care would solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, essentially managed care said, let's create these HMOs, and the HMOs are going to be smart and tough, and they'll hold the cost down.
Right.
It turned out that they did the opposite because they sort of exploded the paperwork, the administrative cost. There's some charts in our longer version of our report that show that at best, a nurse or a doctor spends like at least a third of their time dealing with the paperwork, a third of their time, filling out forms.
Doctors complain about that all the time.
All about the approval process.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need the approval process? Let's just create competition so that the doctor who's going to get your business to treat you has had to compete, who has had to subject themselves to scrutiny in terms of information on their experience, on their outcomes, and that, you know, we can look on a website or we can be advised by our health plan about, okay, let's look at the five leading people in our town that do this particular thing. Which one is the best value?
And yet the inertia here is very strong, and you know it. Employers are not exactly organized to facilitate this kind of transformation of another industry. What about a government role? Is there a government role here?
Well, let's first, Tom, I think employers are getting organized.
Okay.
And there's a number of groups that have formed, the Leapfrog group. There's a variety of alliances. And we're now seeing companies really on this issue because it is a big deal. And in many cases, it's the single largest purchase they make. It's killing them in terms of their cost position.
96% of CEOs significantly or critically concerned about healthcare costs.
Absolutely. So they are getting organized. But so far, they haven't quite seen the problem the right way, and they're focusing on what I would consider little Band-Aid issues. Like, for example, you know, is the emergency room staffed by an emergency room-trained physician?
Okay.
That's a good idea, but it's not a big deal. It's not where the heavy lifting is in terms of improving the system. So I think employers are on the case. They're getting organized. That's why we would look to them as kind of setting the standard for a new system and starting to migrate. But the government may very well have to play a role here. Let's just talk about some of the key areas for government. Number one would be the whole issue of the kind of insurance rules. Right now, one of the problems in the system is that the payer, the health plan, actually has an incentive to try to keep you from being a subscriber if they think you might get sick or if you are sick. So we need to deal with the issue of how to create a fair insurance system where people that have pre-existing conditions don't get denied insurance and so forth. We advocate creating the kind of the equivalent of what would be called an assigned risk pool in the automobile insurance area. It had the same problem in automobile insurance. Some people have bad driving records.
Right.
So what do you do with them? Well, what happens is that there's kind of they get parceled out among all the other insurance providers proportional to their share of the market.
You're saying do the same in
healthcare. Do the same thing in healthcare.
Another thing you want to get rid of, re-underwriting.
Re-underwriting, yeah.
I mean, explain that. I was stunned.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it existed.
Well, what's happened is you can have a health plan, and you may be charged X dollars per year, but if you get sick, they come back to you and say, guess what? Your fee just went up by twice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We argue that that makes no sense. It denies the whole logic of insurance. So, you know, if a health plan wants to raise their rates, they have to do it for everybody. Now, those would be insurance rules that the government might have
all
to
right.
set. We think the government ought to make the health plan the legally responsible party for your bill if you are paid up, so that they can't play games, trying to pass on costs to somebody else. We believe this is more controversial. We believe there should be a national minimum required coverage. That is, rather than have these lawsuits fighting out what your health plan covers,
mm-hmm.
we believe that there should be a blue ribbon panel or some other mechanism created to create a standard health plan. This is what's covered.
And not just what's covered, but as I read you, Michael Porter, that everyone would be covered.
At least to that.
At least to that. So you're talking about universal.
Well, that's another
or required
part of it.
Coverage.
That's another part of it.
I think even
if we didn't have universal health plans, health coverage, which
here's
I
the minimum buffet of things that people will be offered in a health plan.
See, right now, the health plan and you, the subscriber, fight it out
mm-hmm.
one by one,
kind of
lawsuit by lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
negotiate. Well, see, what we advocate actually is that there's a minimum plan that is available to government employees, federal employees.
Right.
There's a fancy name for it
mm-hmm.
that I won't try to remember. And we ought to let's start with that.
That
is the minimum. And anything and any health plan that covers that is not subject to litigation over coverage.
Ah, it's simply that's what it
that's
is.
That's what it is. Okay.
Okay. So all the litigation costs go
right.
out.
So if the health plan wants to cover more, they can do that, but that's voluntary.
But what about the idea then beyond that of requiring health coverage for all? Are you
right.
suggesting that? And can the country afford that?
Yeah. Well, that is we put that in the category of this would really help the system. It would really make the system more effective.
Why?
Well, because right now we have this bizarre situation where a lot of people, you know, 40 million people by some estimates, don't have insurance. But they are getting health care. Either they pay for it when they get sick, which is vastly more expensive than if they pay for it through a plan, or they go to an emergency room or they get uncompensated care. We also think that there's a certain amount of free riding in the system. That is, people who are healthy, people who are young, you know, just opt out. They just say,
don't have health insurance.
Yeah, I just don't have insurance, mm-hmm. and they probably aren't going to need it. But the way the system works is everybody has to pay in when they're young and healthy in order to fund the cost that they're going to impose on the system when they're older and sick.
This is the way it should work.
That's the way it should work.
So you're saying if you require that everyone have health coverage, you avoid the very expensive emergency treatments of some kinds,
right.
and you get those young, healthy people in the pool paying also
right.
in the pool. It's a wash cost-wise.
I don't know how close it is to a wash. You'd also not have any more uncompensated care. Everybody would be a paying customer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we believe that a system in which everybody is a paying customer is going to be a system where a lot of the gaming, cost-shifting, patient dumping that's going on now in the system would really end. However, it's clear we're going to have to provide subsidies to people with low incomes to allow them to buy the coverage, but everybody's going to have coverage. Now, we don't think that very large expensive step is necessary in order to make dramatic improvements in the system, but that takes the transformation of competition to the ultimate extreme.
The system can be fixed, you say, Michael Porter, over how many years? This shift to a truly competitive healthcare industry focused on value, not on cost reduction and on rationing.
Well, it almost depends on us, you know, and how much we want to accept the same old tired excuses for why things can't be changed. I mean, if Medicare decided to re-architect itself around these principles,
mm-hmm.
the system could change in a relatively few years. More realistically, it's going to be some combination of some Medicare adjustments, some employer pressures that are going to start to create the process of change. And maybe a decade from now, I think we can have a meaningfully different feeling and looking system.
But there it is, the radical agenda for making American healthcare something we can live with and afford at the same time. We're talking tonight with Michael Porter, director of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness at Harvard Business School. He's thought a lot about healthcare. He's thought a lot about international competition. We'll come back and look at that in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Michael Porter, university professor at Harvard University, a world-renowned expert on competitive strategy and economic development. He's been writing about it and turning heads for years. We've been talking about healthcare, but Michael Porter, I wish you'd shift gears with us for just a second. Everyone's been talking and thinking over the last, it seems, about a year now about offshoring and new threats to the American economy from countries like India and China that are quite wonderfully exploding with new expertise and the technology that can plug them right into American markets. Do we have a problem here, a new problem here in terms of global competition?
Well, Tom, we certainly don't have a new problem. The whole word offshoring is just another word for something that's been going on for centuries, which is the kind of international specialization of labor. Many products have been manufactured overseas for a long time. This has been going on, accelerating since World War II, and particularly in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, a tremendous amount of globalization of competition. And this is just a manifestation of that globalization. What's different about the current discussion is that it involves services. We're talking about information technology. We're talking about programming software. We're talking about services that are not just services where kind of low-cost labor is involved. Again, we're kind of used to the idea that products that require unskilled labor will be manufactured overseas. Here we're talking about things that engineers do,
right,
that computer programmers do. And, and the basic economics are very compelling in the sense that an engineer in Bangalore is probably one-fourth the cost of an engineer in Boston. So is this a problem? First of all, the problem is greatly exaggerated, to say the least. The number of jobs we're talking about here is relatively small. It might be hundreds of thousands to a million jobs in an economy where there's 100 million jobs.
And when in a good month we're creating sometimes 4 million jobs
right.
a month.
Exactly. Again, let's note that we have been in an economic downturn.
Mm-hmm.
And in that economic downturn, our unemployment rate peaked around 6%.
Not so bad historically.
Not so bad. If we go back to 89, 90, it peaked at more like 9%. So what's going on here is there's actually quite a shortage of workers in America looming. The demographics mean that the number of new workers entering the workforce is actually very low. It's estimated to be about 1% of the workforce per year is entering. But we see that the economy is growing at more than 1% a year. So there's really a looming shortage of workers.
A shortage of workers means the unemployment rate shouldn't get too high. But on the other hand, it doesn't necessarily mean the country is very competitive.
It does not mean that at all. It's clear that this is a healthy trend to the extent that work that doesn't have to be done here and can't be done more productively by Americans shouldn't move offshore. I think that makes our economy more productive. If there's anything disturbing about this, it's the signs that part of the reason for the offshoring is that there's not an adequate supply of the right skills in America. And my biggest concern about U.S. competitiveness, and this is almost the only concern I have, is that we are not generating the output of highly skilled people that we need to support a higher and higher standard of living. Our public school system is well known to be, mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
The number of engineers that is graduating every year in America is flat or even slightly declining at a time when the knowledge intensity of work is going up. So I think that if there's a wake-up call here, it's that we better make sure that Americans are highly skilled and well-trained. A lot of the IT companies that I talk to are putting these jobs overseas because they simply can't find enough qualified engineers in America.
So that American seat at the top of the global economic pyramid, not guaranteed if the education system doesn't do a better job.
Absolutely. Your standard of living, you've got to earn. And you've got to earn it by being more productive. That's the cold, hard truth of international competition. You can't pay yourself more unless you're more productive. And you can't be more productive, usually, unless you have the high levels of skill and if you're not using the latest and best technology. We're pretty good on the technology side. We still are a tremendous innovation machine, very entrepreneurial. Where we fall down a bit is on the skill-based side. And the good news is that America's kind of working on this issue. We've had, unthinkable...
No child left behind? Is that what you're talking about or not?
Well,
testing and all of that?
Accountability. I mean, it's going slowly because of entrenched interest and inertia. But
is that really scratching the itch you're describing here?
That is starting to scratch the itch. One of the problems we have with engineers, scientists and engineers in our workforce is that women and minorities are disproportionately not represented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's now 3 or 4 very interesting initiatives to try to increase that. So I think that there's a lot of positive things going on, but ultimately the biggest vulnerability of the U.S. economy from a competitive standpoint is this issue of skills.
We've just talked about fundamental change in healthcare. What about in education? I don't know if you claim to have looked at it with anything like the same care, but what's your gut tell you? Is it to be done in public schools as traditionally done? Is it to be done in some kind of throw it up in the air and make it all charter schools and competitive schools? Would you bring the same competitive dictate to education that you're bringing to healthcare?
I think, first of all, you've implied already, I think, the truth, and that is that our higher education system is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we have a tremendous net import of people coming to America for higher education. It's pretty good. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of surveys, and you can debate whether schools are being compared on the right thing. But there's a lot of vitality there. The problem actually in higher ed is that the inputs to higher ed are not high enough quality. So
that
a lot
is the graduating high school
students.
Yeah,
the high school kids. And those kids won't even try engineering because they just feel like they're not going
to
make it.
Yep.
So I think the core is really in our primary and secondary system. I believe that without some kind of competition, without some kind of information and comparison, and without some kind of choice, it's very hard to make things better. Although I have no hard and fast views about just how to structure it, I would be experimenting massively on all kinds of things that would allow more choice, would allow more information. I think we ought to be providing scholarship support that allows kids to pick a private school if they can make it. I think we ought to be doing lots of things to provide more competition
and choice. And I can't resist asking you, Michael Porter, I know you bring in new CEOs for training all the time as they buckle into very big corporations and all the responsibility that comes with that. The country right now is interviewing 2 men to see who's going to lead it for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of American leadership, how well is this country led?
Well, that's a very hard question. I tell you what my reaction to that question is, and that is sometimes I wonder if America is capable of being led. It's just such a big, complex country.
But there have been times, Abraham Lincoln, yep. FDR, you can bring yep. it right forward.
Well, I think that there can be periods when there is a series of overarching issues that really can galvanize a leader. But I frankly think that our political system and the political discourse does not encourage or support good leadership.
Too rambunctious?
It's too short-term. It's too focused on the next election cycle. It's like a CEO who gets captivated with the stock price.
Mm-hmm.
We find that some of the most disastrous corporate mistakes are made when the CEO is trying to track the stock price, and minute by minute they're trying to figure out how to get the stock price
up. Is it too much to ask, then, for the country to look for a leader so big in his or her perspective that he can snap the polity out of that and say, we've got bigger issues?
Well, I've been dreaming and indeed yearning for a shift in the whole election politics system away from what I consider largely meaningless dialogues on largely minor things to this kind of a discussion about, okay, who is really well-equipped to lead in the long run. I mean, in the area of healthcare, which we talked about earlier,
yeah.
really neither side is addressing the fundamental issues facing the
system.
Republicans or Democrats. There's small differences in their proposals, but basically it's all about how much more money is government going to put in the system. The fact that we would try to solve our healthcare problem by buying prescription drugs in Canada is ludicrous.
Talk about cost shifting.
It's cost shifting. Now, if some president wanted to say, okay, look, the whole way we pay for prescription drugs in the world and the cross-subsidy of Americans to the rest of the world has got to change, I would respect that. But again, we're talking on the margin about little things, and unfortunately, that's too much of the political discourse in America.
Michael Porter, looking for a big thinker, a big doer, somebody who to address the fundamentals. Wow, just terrific having you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and just a delight being here.
Michael Porter, university professor at Harvard. His article, Redefining Competition in Healthcare, appears in the June issue of Harvard Business Review. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, lessons one man has learned from the goofy green ogre Shrek. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After another big weekend at the box office, Shrek 2 has now surpassed the earnings of the original Shrek and may be on track to best Finding Nemo as the top-grossing animated film of all time.
So, I suppose any grandchildren I could expect from you would be...
Ogres. Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Right, Harold?
Oh, no! No, of course not. That is, assuming you don't eat your own young...
Dad!
Oh, no, we usually prefer the ones who've been locked away in a tower.
Shrek, please.
I only did that because I love her.
Oh, hi. Daycare or Dragon Guarded Castle?
You wouldn't understand. You're not her father.
The continued success of the goofy green ogre, his donkey sidekick, and his princess bride has led DreamWorks to fast-track production of Shrek 3... and the groundwork for Shrek 4 is already being laid. California writer Emil Guillermo is one of many Americans who have been caught up in the Shrek phenomenon. In this radio diary, he says it may be just a cartoon fantasy, but Shrek offers real lessons for race relations in America.
I have seen the future of race relations in America. It's that subversive little movie called Shrek 2, where the bad guys are fairy godmothers and handsome princes, and the good guys, ogres and asses. If you've had a difficult time grasping the true meaning of the greatness of multiculturalism or diversity in this country, preferring instead to rail against the balkanization of America or to mourn the loss of a great American homogeneity, then get thee to your nearest 64-plex, where the sequel to the hit from summer 2001 seems to be playing in half the theaters. Get ready to be Shrek'd. Or maybe you already have been. There's a reason a movie about a lime green ogre who marries a princess has been the nation's number one movie, and why I still prefer it to the latest Harry Potter franchise. The movie speaks the truth about where this country's moving in regard to race and culture and diversity. But thank God it's in cartoon form, because many people are still not ready for the truth. The truth? America is more heterogeneous than ever. We're great blenders. The movie put a point on it when it revealed indirectly, of course, that fire-breathing flying dragons can have sex with donkeys and produce cute little fire-breathing flying asses. In some ways, Shrek 2 is the 21st century equivalent of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. In that 1967 film, amid America's early struggle with civil rights, Sidney Poitier played a black doctor whose white fiancé invites him home to meet the parents, played by Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. What ensues is a dialogue-rich exposé of the entrenched middle-class racism of the time. In 2004, Shrek is the happy-go-lucky ogre who rescues and marries a princess and then gets invited by her to meet Mom and Dad, ye old king and queen. It's the same story with cultures clashing and tensions rising between Shrek and the king, especially on the subject of children. Oh, what will the children be like? And then there are all the fill-in-the-blank jokes. Here it's about ogres, but you can substitute your favorite ethnic group about how they burp and pass wind indiscriminately. Sidney Poitier didn't drink out of a finger bowl like Shrek did, but the awkward moments based on skin color differences in the two films are similar. Yet nearly 40 years later, America's racial themes are more complicated than ever. Shrek has to be lime green. What other color can he be? America isn't just black or white or brown anymore. The last U.S. Census put the number of those who said they are descended from two or more races at 6.8 million, equivalent to 2.4% of the country. It's a crazy mulatto world. Get used to it. What Shrek 2 does do is expose the M.O. racists use to marginalize everyone else. Racists tend to turn their targets into subhumans, animals, monsters, and boogeymen, all much easier to hate than real humans. But Shrek is a congenial, lucky, macho ogre with a Scottish accent. By making him the hero, the filmmakers have turned the hate object into the love object and have come up with the best icon since Barney the Purple Dinosaur to preach tolerance and acceptance. And that latter quality includes self-acceptance. Shrek plays a handsome white guy for about a quarter of the movie, but choosing ogredom in the end, learns to love his lime-green self. That's not a knock on pretty boy white guys, either. It's Shrek's inner self singing as soul brother number one James Brown would have in Shrek's oversized shoes, "Say it loud, I'm an ogre and proud." What I hope doesn't happen is that people leave the 64-plex thinking they've just seen a nice little film about ogres. That's the problem with the cartoon. It's both an aid and a curse. Under the guise of a movie for kids are some important ideas that are subversive to the status quo. The problem is that some people miss out because they see Shrek 2 as kid stuff. But I'm hoping that one day we won't need a cartoon to tell us the hard truth. It'll just be too hard to deny. Shrek 2 ain't Drek. It's a celebration of a new world and a new America. where fire-breathing donkey dragons really do fly.
Now, we're people. We like the birds and the bees. We'd rather die on our feet than keep living on our knees. Say it loud!
Emil Guillermo is a radio and TV commentator and the author of Amok, Essays from an Asian American Perspective, which won an American Book Award. He is a former host of NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.